Thanks very much, Cormac. Tonight on Arena, we review Munich's from David Peace and the movie Sing Sing, Oddity and Touch, and we celebrate 30 years of Definitely Maybe from Oasis. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us live on rte.ie/arena. Great to be saying all of that again. Great to be back in the seat. Major thanks to my Arena colleagues for their support over the summer months, and in particular to Kay Sheehy, who stepped into the breach with grace and aplomb, the way she does everything. But it is wonderful to be back in the seat. And tonight in our film reviews, a Shawshank for the 21st century, a creepy Irish horror, and a love story told across time and continents. Sing Sing, in that film, Oscar nominee Coleman Domingo has a shot at a second Academy Awards nod for his role as a wrongly convicted man who finds solace in the theatre. In Oddity, a woman with an interest in the occult seeks to expose the truth of her sister's murder. And we go from Iceland to Tokyo and London in search of first love in the trans-global romance Touch. Serena Bellissimo and Declan Burke have been to see the movie for us. They're with me in studio this evening. Let's start with Sing Sing, new feature film from director Greg Quidar, who was Kay's guest on Arena, in fact, earlier this week. This is a story of redemption inside one of New York's most notorious high security prisons, Sing Sing. But what's remarkable here is the fact that many of the performers are men who came through the prison system and who found solace and purpose in an extraordinary theatre programme running there. The theatre programme in and of itself, Declan, is an extraordinary thing. Where are we at with the film? What's the line between fact and fiction here?
It's kind of nicely blurred. So it's the rehabilitation through the arts programme is the theatrical group that is set up in Sing Sing. And Coleman Domingo plays a character who is, he's the creative heart of this group. He not only acts, he also writes plays. Very serious man. He has aspirations to play Hamlet, for example. And how it manages to kind of blur the lines is that many, as you say, of the theatrical group are played by people who came through this programme.
So they're playing themselves.
And are not only playing ex-inmates, but are playing themselves, playing them, you know, the characters that they played in these roles. So it's almost roles within roles within roles. And on top of that, then what we have is a group of men who are in a brutalizing institution, and who are then kind of forced to adopt certain personas in order to survive. And there's like the character who comes in, the Divine Eye, Clarence Macklin plays him, playing who is also an ex-inmate. So he comes in all edgy, swagger and bluster and so forth, and he has adopted a persona on the outside to survive on the streets. And there's lots of, as I say, roles within roles within roles.
And interestingly enough, the character, of course, that Domingo is playing is based on a real life character. Divine G.
Yeah.
He is based on a real life character.
He is. And I think the reason why this works so beautifully, and I have to say, I was thinking about this film long after I'd left the film, and that's always a sign of a really good film. I think the reason why this works so well is that I couldn't tell, like usually when stuff like this happens, you know, you have actors who had never acted before. Sometimes it's a bit of a gimmick, but I felt I couldn't tell the difference. I didn't know until the end. And that comes from Coleman Domingo, because he was outstanding as Divine G, but he also understood it's okay to let everybody else shine around me, because if they shine, we all shine. And that's what happened. It sounds really corny, but that's what happened with this film. It's such a beautiful film.
Let's have a listen to Domingo in action. Shakespeare's Hamlet is hugely important in the film, as we'll hear in this clip taken from the trailer, but we'll also get a sense of Domingo's work here as Divine G.
To die, to sleep, to dream.
This is a clemency hearing for your conviction, 25 to life. Since you've been in custody, you've been involved in a theater program.
It's been a program that was established to help people get more in touch with their feelings and it truly get some rehabilitation.
I am Gladiator Goliath, and I am I'm Prince Hamlet of Denmark.
And it's turned into something, I don't know, wonderful.
What part do you play?
From time to time, I do act, like we all do.
So are you acting at all during this interview?
A clip there from Sing Sing. Interestingly, I was listening to Kay's interview with the director during the week and talking about this amateur non-actors and professional actors. How does that? How did that mix work for you? So, I mean, Serena's saying clearly it was she didn't notice the joins, but Domingo has to take a lot of the praise for that.
He does. I was saying to Serena before we came in that I do my best not to watch trailers and not to know very much about a film before I sit down and watch it. So you're watching it with a kind of, it's a blank slate. It was only as the film progressed that it dawned on me. I started to wonder, are these guys actually in this? Are they? And it actually, I feel kind of bad that we're having this conversation because it's going to spoil it for people who go and watch it, because there's an electrifying effect. You mentioned the Oscar word there in the introduction as well, and I think Domingo is definitely going to be in the conversation, even though this film is quite early, quite nearly released.
Although lots of people talking about Clarence as well, isn't there? Yeah.
So he's absolutely brilliant because Domingo is a professional actor. We expect a certain standard. He's a wonderful he's a wonderful actor. But what Clarence Macklin brings to the role, it's as if he has walked off the street into this prison. I mean, really, it's such an immersive experience watching this film because, exactly the questions you're asking me, because of the authenticity that these men bring to the roles.
And the exteriors are Sing Sing prison itself. And then the interiors are a decommissioned prison where some of these men spent time.
Yeah, I spoke to Greg as well about that. And I said to him, how did it feel? Like, you know, you're asking these men not just to be in a film, reliving an experience they've had, but actually putting on those prison greens again and going into a jail. And he said a lot of them turned around and went, it's tough, but it's great because I know I can walk out the door. Can I just say, though, this sounds very, very serious. There's a lot of levity. Yeah, it's actually, it's got a bit of everything. And it's great because it's an hour and 45 minutes long. They don't drag it out. And it's not that Hollywood sappiness either. You see the good, the bad. And this program's amazing. Like, it was 75% of men who have been a part of this program have not re-offended.
Yeah, and
that's huge.
That's a huge statistic. Rehabilitation through the arts, hats off, obviously, to all of the programs that are doing that type of thing, not just in America, but worldwide. Stars from you on this one, Serena?
I'm giving this a 5.
A 5, straightforward. Yeah. And Declan?
A strong 4 stars from
you. A strong 4 stars from you. All right, let us move on then to Oddity, new psychological horror from Irish writer and director Damien McCarthy. Film won the Audience Award in the Midnighter section at the South by Southwest Festival earlier this year. Danny is brutally murdered at a remote country house that she and her husband Ted are renovating. Everyone suspects a patient from the local mental health institution where Ted, that's the husband, is a doctor. A year later, however, Danny's blind sister, her blind twin sister and self-proclaimed psychic Darcy pays Ted a visit. Even as I read that, this is an amazing, this is, to me, sounds like a great setup. And I believe the opening section, the opening scenes, Declan, are breathtaking.
Yeah, exactly that, Sean. The opening, the whole setup in which Danny is at home alone because Ted is working at nights in the psychiatric institution, and there's a knock on the door, and it's a guy who's obviously an escaped patient from the institution, and he's saying to her, look, I've just seen someone go into the house behind you. I need to come in and check to make sure you're okay. And Danny is thinking, yes, that sounds very reasonable, doesn't it? And of course, you're screaming at the screen, do not open the
door. Don't go down to the basement. Don't let the man in.
Exactly. But, you know, it's a brilliantly gripping. It sucks you in straight away, sets up kind of incredibly creepy vibe. And it does what a good horror should do. It unsettles you. It wrongfoots you right from the start.
I thought for a minute there that you were actually going to put your hands over your ears, as Declan described.
Do you know what? It's taken me straight back there, Sean, and I'm not happy. Like, this is how much I love you and this show, because I don't do horrors, and I walked in and I went, never again. I'm not doing it again. I wish I checked my Apple Watch to see what my heartbeat was, because I wasn't the better for it. I had my, not, you know, usually I cover my eyes. I covered my eyes and my ears.
Four hands.
It was just too much. At one stage, apparently I jumped quite a few times, and there was a friend a little bit down from my car, and she turned to me and she went, "You made me jump from your jumping." It's just... I mean, I hated this film, but for all the right reasons. And I think Damon McCarthy has basically hit the nail on the head. If you're looking for a horror, maybe I'm just a wuss. I couldn't do this. It's just too much.
A hard man, Declan Burke, is sitting beside you with a grimace on his face of total indifference. Were you frightened? Because you did like that opening.
I was.
Did it stay with you?
I was fully gripped. And what I liked about the how it then proceeded was, it's not just a psychological horror with kind of gothic tropes. It becomes a revenge thriller. You mentioned that Danny's twin sister, Darcy, who is blind and self-proclaimed psychic, she suspects that there was foul play, that the reasons given for Danny's death are not true.
And so, she's a little bit suspicious about Ted, the husband, the new girlfriend.
Well, he has got a new girlfriend, Yana, played by Caroline Menton, who's terrific. But Darcy invites herself to the remote country home with a life-size golem, a wooden carved figure in tow. And Ted says, "Oh yeah, no, that seems to be a good idea. Why don't you just sit down and put the golem on the couch?" It becomes a revenge thriller then, and a very unusual revenge thriller, because Darcy is blind. She's effectively, or ostensibly, helpless. But of course, this is a psychological horror movie, so she's not at all helpless.
Oh, I see. Now, we're not going to hear her. Carolyn Bracken, who actually plays she plays both parts, doesn't she?
The twins and the two twins.
We are going to hear, however, Caroline Menton, who's in the room with her, or certainly in the house with her, and is not at all happy with this situation, and phones Ted to say, "Get over here quick, I'm not happy."
"She's not going to do anything. And even if she wanted to, I think you could handle one small blind woman. Just say goodnight, go to bed, and lock the door."
"I'm going to make some calls, see if I can get out of here."
"Do, because she's freaking me out with all this stuff. How does she even know Ivan?"
"I don't know. I'll be there as quick as I can."
I don't know if I trust him now. And don't give anything away. Now. That's a scene from Oddity, Damien McCarthy, and it wasn't Caroline Brackett. It was Caroline Merton, isn't it? Menton, who was playing the part of the new girlfriend there. Did you find yourself then just not trusting anybody and frightened of everybody in this?
I was. It's just creepy. Even listening back to that, you can hear the atmospheric music in the background. And look, there is a twist. And I have to say, when the twist came, I went, "Hold on a second. Did I just get scared for nothing?" And I was really upset at the twist. But then as it went on, I went, "Oh no, this is a really good twist." So like, there will be points throughout the film where you'll sit there and go, "Oh, I don't like where this is going." Yeah. But the payoff all happens at the end. So sit through it, because they know what they're doing. It's all just right. Creepy. If you don't want to be creeped out, don't go to this. But if you do, definitely do.
Stars from you, Serena?
Oh, 5 scary stars.
Oh, you have 5?
No, because I'm scared. So I don't know. Like, I'm just scared.
That's what they want.
You're scared not to give it 5.
Exactly.
Declan?
It's certainly creepy and definitely terrific ideas. I don't think they quite gel the way Damien McCarthy wanted them to. 3 stars from me.
And a lot of ambition, I think you were saying.
Yeah, very ambitious. A lot to applaud about the film. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to our final film then, Touch. After receiving an early stage dementia diagnosis at the outset of the COVID-19 pandemic, Icelandic widower Christopher leaves behind his Reykjavik home in the hope of finding his first love, Japanese girl Miko, who had worked with him in London some 50 years ago and disappeared without trace at the time. My steady heart be still. This sounds like a gorgeous love story.
Oh, this is beautiful. I'm like Declan. I go into stuff and I don't watch trailers. I feel like trailers now give you the whole story. I walked into this not knowing what to expect. Oh, my poor heart. It was such a beautiful film. It's a story about love, but not just romantic love, also love in your life, living life to the fullest. You've got young love when you see them both as the younger characters. You've got hope for life. You've got, even though, you know, they're coming to the end of their life, there is still hope and you can dream and you can go after what you want. And it's just so beautifully shot as well across Tokyo, London and Iceland.
Iceland. And obviously, so we're in, I suppose, the present day moment is the just before COVID-19, just as the pandemic was starting. But we go back to the 1960s, which is what Serena mentioned there about the younger characters. How well does that device work in terms of the, you know, the across the timeline thing? Because I suppose you have to empathise with both the older character and the younger character.
Yeah, it works brilliantly, Sean. I mean, at least half the film, if not more, is told in flashback. It's two parallel stories, effectively. Yeah. And we have the older Christopher, who is, you know, as you said, he's facing into rather tough time. He's a widower. But he exudes this beautiful Zen-like quality that seems to have a soothing effect on everyone around him. And everybody seems to respond very well to him. Then we meet the younger Christopher, who's a firebrand socialist student, long hair, packs it all in because he's disgusted with, you know, the politics and the institution and goes to wash dishes. And he's this shy, diffident guy. And you mentioned he does fall in love with the very beautiful Miko.
Pepe Kauki, who's a model and singer-songwriter, isn't she?
And another terrific, across the board, the performances are terrific in this. But he falls in love with Japanese culture. And as Serena was saying, this is a film about falling in love with life itself.
And in fact, the young Christopher is played by the director's son. We kind of cast at the last minute in that fashion. But let's have a listen to him in action. This is back in the 1960s in London when himself and Kauki are just meeting. He's working in her boss is, or his boss is her dad. Yeah. So they're working in the same restaurant.
Dad says you want to be a cook.
He told you that?
Mm-hmm.
No. Well, I just want to see if I can make the, you know, the traditional breakfast properly.
And who's going to be the judge of that?
Me, I guess.
Do you want me to come?
Yes. But you can't be too tough on me, though.
Are you afraid of that?
Yes. Miko, I'm terrified of you.
There we go. Palmi Kamakur, the son of the director, and Kauki, usually a singer-songwriter and a model. Beautiful chemistry between the two of them there in that scene,
Beautiful
Serena.
Beautiful chemistry between all of them. And I think the accidental casting of people who were perfect for this role also plays into this. Because, like, we had Palmi, who didn't even want to audition. And the casting director
said, wanted to be behind the camera.
Yeah.
He wasn't interested in
And the casting director went, go ahead. Egil Olufsen, who plays the older, why can't I remember his name?
But Christopher.
Who plays the older Christopher. He's been diagnosed with Parkinson's Plus. So, like, he's...
And wasn't there something in his, was it his mother?
There was
went in search of her first love in this fashion.
Yeah, and then, get this, it gets even better. So, like, I do the deep dive after the film. The casting director couldn't find someone to play the older Miko, and they went, you would be perfect for it. So she was talked into casting herself.
She cast herself. Oh,
it's
wow.
Just, and we're talking outside as well. There's a lot of things going on, but there's no finger pointing at, you know, why the dad does what he does or why people have done what they do. It's such a gentle, beautiful film.
And this is not, Declan, the sort of film, I think, that Balthasar Kormákur that we would think of. Isn't he generally big action movies?
Yeah, and this film, I mean, you were kind of saying, Be Still My Beating Heart at the start in the intro. This is a gorgeously old-fashioned romance, but it's not a romance that's kind of isolated from the rest of the world. Like most of the film takes place, or a lot of the film takes place in the late 1960s, and we were reminded very starkly that that's only two decades on, one generation on from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And without saying too much about that, how it affects the film, because there will be spoilers, what we're getting is a story about people who are effectively trying to confront history with a capital H. And the story is all about how do you go about carving out your own life. And that's why I think the unnecessary COVID pandemic aspect of the story is there as well, because it had such a huge impact on so many lives across the globe.
Yeah, so did you feel there was a bit of a lack of need that, for the COVID-19 story?
That was the only thing that I had against this film. I just went, I didn't mind that it was in it, but I was going, it didn't necessarily need it. I get why it was there, but probably didn't need to be there. But regardless, go see it. It's 90 minutes of your life that you will love while you're watching.
Yeah, that you won't be looking to get them back.
Exactly.
All right, stars from you on this one, Declan.
Yeah, beautifully acted, deeply immersive and wholly affecting. Strong 4 stars.
Strong again. 4.
I'm giving it a 5 as well.
You've had 5, a good week.
Yeah, 5 stars across the board. I wasn't scared in this one. I may have cried, though.
Frightened, cried, and were interested. 3 good films, obviously. Serena Bellissimo and Declan Burke are 2 reviewers on this Thursday evening. Sing Sing, Oddity and Touch, the 3 films that they were speaking about. Last Tuesday, to the delight of their legions of fans, Noel and Liam Gallagher announced that they were burying the hatchet and would finally get together and play a series of live gigs in the UK and Ireland. 15 years after they last played on stage in Paris at Rock and Seine. That gig was also 15 years after the band released their debut album, Definitely Maybe. Today, that album, this very day, in fact, was released. And to mark the date, an anniversary edition of the album is being released tomorrow. DJ Kate Brennan Harding, big fan of the band and of this album in particular, is with me in studio now. Before we speak to Kate, let's go back 30 years to 1994 and take a listen to 2 young Mancunian lads chatting at a festival.
I'm Noel.
And my name's Liam. I'm the singer and he's a guitarist songwriter.
I'm a guitar songwriter. Been together about, got together in about 1991. Done a few gigs, farting about for a bit around Manchester, nothing was happening.
Just rehearsing, getting our sound. And then we went one day, we just went, right, you up for it, old beam?
Oh, yes.
I went, I'm mad for it, let's go and have the world.
Shocks away, Ginger.
Shocks away.
They were great pals back then. That's not Kate Brennan Harding. That's Noel and Liam Gallagher having a chat at the very beginning of their career. What a week it has been for Oasis fans.
It's been...
Now, let's be very clear. We asked you to do this Definitely Maybe retrospective a long time ago, long before there was any talk of a reunion.
This was booked months ago, and actually it's lovely for me because the first time I was on Arena, I was talking about Definitely Maybe 25. So now it's lovely 5 years later, here I am having the chats. Never in my wildest dreams, well, my hopes, I thought, would I think that I'd be here after Oasis announced that they're coming back together, going to be playing. It's going to be carnage on Saturday with everyone trying to get tickets. But here we are, they're back. And did you know, it's not just 15 years. It's 14 years, 11 months and 30 days since they broke up. And from the debut album to when they broke up, it's 14 years, 11 months and 30 days. So, trippy.
So you're playing with some months have 30 days and some months have 31 days?
No, because they released 29, 28, 27. See,
they made
I'm now adding those into my lotto numbers.
Obviously, somebody, there was a numerology. Maybe it was numerology that brought them back together. That's what solved the rows.
Maybe. I mean, the thing is, it's interesting. We hear the Oasis, we hear Noel and Liam having the chats there, and they fought like cat and dog for all of their childhood. They have a really interesting fraught history. I think, you know, I'm a massive fan of the band, and I think that the two of them, that's what creates the chemistry. That's what makes it magic.
I want to play a little bit of Definitely Maybe before we go to the notes, but you got to remember they were actually a relatively young band with not that much gigging under their belt when they released this album, or when they started to working on the album.
Completely. Maybe. Like, they reformed in 91 because Noel had discovered that Liam had started a band called The Rain, which had the 4 original members, and then Noel came along. He played them a song, everything was magic, bang, they're called Oasis, and then they got signed in 1993.
All right, now we're going to play a little bit of Up in the Sky, because this is the story of this is they started in one studio, they went to a second studio, they went to a third studio, but this is in this anniversary release, we're getting stuff from all 3 studios, are we?
We're getting stuff from 2 sessions of recordings. And we're getting stuff we've never heard before, and this is one song.
Yeah, so this is Oasis Up in the Sky in the first studio that they went to.
Hey,
There you go, Up in the Sky, in a version that we don't normally hear from Oasis.
Completely.
The Oasis album, definitely, maybe Kate Brennan Harding. Just explain why that is so different from the one that we may know from the original album, Kate.
Exactly. So imagine that these five young lads are brought to Mono Valley to record. They're set up in a system that doesn't make sense to them. They're set up each individual, including Liam's in his
separate
isolated
rooms
booth,
and everything.
Separate
yeah.
rooms, and they're set to record. Dave Batchelor was the producer at the time, a legendary producer. And they were trying to work to get the Oasis sound, but they couldn't figure out how to translate that live. Now, what's interesting about the Mono Valley recordings, on this new edition of Definitely Maybe, Oasis fans have never gotten so much new yeah. stuff. So this one is brilliant because it's been mixed and mastered, but it doesn't deliver what Oasis are live. And so it got scrapped. All of those recordings were scrapped because they sound too clinical.
Right, well, we'll come back to whether we should even be listening to them then if they weren't scrapped. In a bit, but we will have to wait to do that until Tairis na nuacht there. All leaven ish eg shocked the clog or RT Radio hin eg gormlan I hurishk.
Bala yere. Tabert Wachlis na déag a gavlíantach a gestu ag Napoléon I America fwy gúnwaru Sean Brady chúig vlíant agus chásgúr gís a sin éanach a gondé hibridáran o rúchas. Cahu agus maréva tíva mógan vílan vi ege tréis a kúgachlog trinún in ney. Cáli os kin tríche dine aga daibre sa gólacht Cardinal Health a dalach wór in ei fáli agus e tukale fisk gúlan kólacht le dúna fwy arach na bliana rávíl agus a fiche sé. Tá gúin scéal gan na Hoibríe ag cruinniú a thagraíomh gan chuine ar maidin inniu. Dúirt Aisling Dunn ón gcuard chumann siptú a dhéanann ionadaíocht ar an gcuid is mó gan éireann gur tháinig an scéal i níor a dua orthu. Teag tar inis go bhfuil an obair i bhíoch ar bun sa monarcha le naistrú go dtí an téalainn nó Costa Rica. Cuirú Kieran Murray, ach mbliana fiad gaois as gur tá neamhail a gcuathair ghaire siar faoi chuineáil inniumh agus é cúisí faoi bhean chuig bhliana le cois na trí scóir a éignú agus a ghúnmharú ag a deireadh seachtaine. Fríú corp Montserrat Martorell ar bheat an Spáinn rúchas é in árasán ar Freud Harvey in aice le lórchaithir ghaire de Sáran Seacate. Tá sé cura i le Kieran Murray freisin gur chuir sé an tárasán sé hinne. Túrár os cúr cúrta i ríiste ar an séúla fichead gan bhí seo thugann. Tá chearach an dhéag Mary ar an mruch hir ó chuid Israel tús lena go ionsaí sa réigiún na né. Deir na húdaráis in Israel gur feachtas frís gebhlaitheoireachta ar tair bunacúin sin. Tá achan dianta ag ordrúnaí na náisiún Intia Antonio Guterres ar Israel na hunsaí a stopa. Tugu Martin Mittmans Gruber atá leichead bliain gaois agus a bhfuil seola san ostáir aige os cúir cúrta a litir canan i gondé rúnangáil agus é cúisia faoi thumáint chuntúirteach in Inver áit ar a timpiste ag ghá chóir de dúna seacate. Gortaíomh Elizabeth Cave, 6 mbliana agus chéad scóir as baile rúnangáil go dúna sa timpiste agus bhása sí in ospidéal tigí in né. Agus leis sin snéad na príomhscéalta gon tráise.
Agus míle buíochas le Gormlan Ní Hurishk an sin sa seomra nuachta. Yes, you're listening to Thursday Night's Arena in our 6:30 slot for the summer period. And with me in studio is Kate Brennan Harding. We dipped into a little bit of Definitely Maybe, the Oasis album, which is celebrating its not a quite its 30th birthday. You can work out the number of days.
Well, yeah, no, it's exactly 30 years today that it was released, but it's more just the synchronicity of their announcement and everything. You know?
All right, and we know the big gigs are coming up and all of that. But you're looking at this anniversary edition of the album for us, Kate, and we touched on the fact that it started in one set of studios, it moved to a second set, and then it finally moved on to a third place. So let's just go back to what we were listening to before the nuke there, which was, you know, that version of Up in the Sky, which you're saying, should it have seen the light of day?
Well, the thing is, I'm delighted that it's seeing the light of day right now.
But is because that because you're a super fan?
It is because I'm a super fan, but it also, in terms of music lovers, in terms of watching how a band organically gets together or how they figure out and they're kind of like tinkering with things and putting things together. And I love that we're now getting a glimpse of what Oasis could have sounded like. And Alan McGee, who's Creation Records, who signed them famously in Glasgow, he signed them in May 1993. Supersonic was out in April 1994. That was when the debut single was out and the album came out in August. So it was a quick turnaround in terms of trying to get them ready. But it's also really interesting to note that the Definitely Maybe reissue that we're getting as I said, we're getting the Mono Valley recordings. And I think it's almost like getting a whole new album. And if that album had been released, if Alan McGee had not put his foot down and said, no, this isn't good enough, it's not respecting who you are as a band, we would have a very different Oasis. And I don't think we would have, we would be sitting here with the way we are now.
Yeah, well, it's amazing that because more than Alan McGee listened to that first version of the album from the Mono Valley studios, mm-hmm. and said, no, you need to hold it off. It's not quite there yet.
It was, everyone said that it wasn't there yet. And Noel was, you know, eager to release.
And then, a little bit frustrated. You can understand. What age was he? 18, 19?
No. Noel was in his mid-20s at that stage. Liam was only a baby. But the thing is that they wanted to release and then they just gone in and recorded. So then they go to Sawmill Studios. So they sent them up. First of all, they recorded Supersonic separately again. And they got Mark Coyle to produce this. Mark Coyle was Noel's best friend. And he was their live mixing engineer. So he captured that. The version of Supersonic that we know is actually the demo version, or considered the demo version. So they thought, okay, Mark can get it. He captures our live sound. So they go to Sawmill Studios. They set up again. They put all the guitarists and the drums in the one room and they isolate Liam. They record. They produce. They create something. It's still not hitting the mark, even though Mark Coyle is a brilliant producer and he was trying to get it right.
Well, let's have a listen to Columbia, which is from the Sawmills session. So this is an outtake, and some of these outtakes are on this anniversary edition for the absolute completists and total Oasis fan. This is the, again, scrapped version of Columbia. So I was asking you as we were listening to that, Kate Brennan Hardy, that is the Columbia from the Oasis album, Definitely Maybe, but not the version that we are used to hearing. That is a version from the second set of recordings that were made in the Sawmill Studios and subsequently scrapped. But I was asking, was that Liam singing there?
That's Liam singing.
And doing the falsetto that Noel would normally do.
Noel has, though. So the thing is, with the Sawmill sessions, they actually kept all the recordings, produced them. It was Mark Coyle who produced them. And then when they realised that they couldn't use those, they kept the same recordings, the same stems, and they brought in Owen Morris. So it's the same recordings with outtakes that were then became Definitely Maybe. And then what we're getting now is the outtakes from that. So Noel normally sings the falsetto on most of the tracks, and it's unusual to hear Liam singing. So singing that both parts.
But if looking at that, so from Mono Valley Studios to the Sawmill Studios and then Creation Records basically coming on board, and Johnny Marr was part of all of this, wasn't his studios, was that where the final version of the album certain sections of it were done?
Certain sections. So Slide Away was done there. So Johnny Marr came on board in terms of he had gotten to know Noel and he sent him a Les Paul guitar. So Noel had been using an Epiphone and he sent him a Les Paul guitar, and Slide Away was created on that Johnny Marr guitar. The thing with the Sawmill sessions, and that's what I love about how, you know, we go back to the Beatles, George Martin was the fifth Beatle. We look at producers these days and they make or break an album. So when Owen Morris came in, took over, what he did was he took the Sawmill recordings and he started adding trippy kind of overdubs. He started overdubbing guitars, loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of overdub. He started reverbing the sound, the Liam's vocals a bit more. He added in kind of more percussion on top of the percussion that was already there.
And playing with that percussion, the
playing
beats,
with it. And that developed. That then finally they had what the Oasis sound live was caught on record.
Yeah, and I was asking, sad song, which I think is a really fine Oasis song, in fact. But it wasn't actually on the album. Yeah, we're going to listen to two different versions of it.
Two different versions. So the one thing about Oasis is that they have a colossal back catalogue of B-sides, to the point of they've released the Master Plan a couple of years ago, which has all the B-sides on them. Noel actually sings a lot more of the B-sides because generally they're more acoustic or they're gentler, and they had such a body of work that they were like, we're not going to put these, we don't have enough room to put this on Definitely Maybe. So Sad Song is one of those tracks where we're used to singing, hearing Noel sing. And one of the things that we're getting again with this new edition is a different version. Now, this was recorded in 1992.
No, but we're going to listen to the Noel version.
Version first,
let's
yeah.
Let's listen to the Noel version, which is the version we're more,
we all know,
we're more
yeah.
used to. Let's have listened to that first.
Sing a sad song in a lonely place. Try to put a word in for me. It's been so long since I found a space. You better put in two or three. We as people are just walking round. Our heads are firmly fixed in the ground. What we don't see, well, it can't.
Okay, so that is Noel Gallagher singing Sad Song, and not on the Definitely Maybe album, but certainly in their, I suppose, their whatever their panorama at that time. It was a song written in and around that time, and certainly referring to Manchester, and kind of a love song to Manchester in some ways, isn't it?
A love song to Manchester and to his younger self, I think. An awful lot of, like, you know, people talk about how anthemic Oasis songs are, and they are. And people kind of deride Oasis as well for kind of ripping off other bands, which every band does. But one of the things is Noel's got some beautiful lyrics, and he's got kind of a real nostalgia brain, and he's got a romantic sense of view, yeah. I think.
And there's a softer feel and a nostalgic feel off the version that we just heard. However, 1992 then, Liam, this is the version that we have never heard before up until this point either, had we?
Yeah, exactly.
Until this release?
This is a brand new version that people wouldn't have heard. And I think what's gorgeous about getting access to this is, like, the band, as I said, in 1992, 1993, they were writing lots and lots of songs in the Boardwalk basement in Manchester. They had songs that ended up on Be Here Now, the third album. They had such a body of work. This one was recorded in 1992, just at a recording session, and Liam is singing it.
Sing a sad song in a lonely place. Try to put a word in for me. It's been so long since I found a space. You'd better put in two or three. We as people are just walking round. Our heads are firmly fixed in the ground. What we don't
now, that's a kind of a soft side of Liam, but it still has a kind of a dangerous element to it that, for me, Noel Gallagher just simply doesn't have when he's singing a sad song.
Do you think?
I do.
I suppose, you know, I love the raw swagger. I love a good rock and roll star.
Maybe swagger's a better way of putting it. Yeah.
Like, yeah, like nobody else. But I think that song, you can hear the vulnerability in his voice, and I think it makes it more romantic and more beautiful, because you know what kind of, especially in 1992, what kind of a leery Manchester guy he was, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, I suppose you have to look at what they achieved for Manchester. We're going to be continuing to talk about Manchester shortly, and we'll be talking about David Peace's book, Munich, about the air disaster and the Manchester United Football Club. What they achieved as a band, they keep around. So I saw an interview with Noel where he was saying, oh, the decision for us to get back together, the people decided.
Yeah. They're so brilliant.
Not short on arrogance.
No,
there.
But they're so brilliant on being able to take the mickey. And I think that's because of their Irish roots. Like, if you ever see them interviewed with their mum, Peggy Gallagher, they have an awful lot of kind of that jovial fun. You never know what's serious, what's not serious. I'm delighted they're back together. I'm really delighted that this album released tomorrow has so much extra on it, because if you're an Oasis fan, you've never ever gotten access to that. And the other thing is that there's plenty and plenty of new Oasis fans who weren't alive the first time round. And, you know, I was at Liam Gallagher down at Thomond Park, and there was such a mix of ages. It was gorgeous to see. So I'm looking forward to seeing the same for the Oasis reunion.
And you'll be up at Cockcrow on Saturday morning, I presume, to buy your tickets.
Absolutely.
For probably all the venues that they're going to.
Oh, yeah, I want to go to the first gig, but yeah, absolutely.
First single, April 1994, ahead of the release of the album Supersonic. Mm. When Oasis put this out as their calling card, what did they do?
Well, they put Supersonic out. They started touring. They went on Top of the Pops. They ended up, I think Supersonic is one hell of a debut single. Then they released Shaker Maker, was their second single. And then they were huge. They were huge before the album was released. When the album was released, it was the fastest selling rock and roll album in England by a British band ever. 100,000 album sales in 4 days.
Yeah.
Massive.
And here is that first single. There we have it, Supersonic, the debut single, and leading into the debut album, definitely maybe 30 years old this very day. Kate Brennan-Harding speaking to us about that. The debut album, definitely maybe, there's a new anniversary edition available right now, and tickets for Oasis, the gigs in Ireland, go on sale on this coming Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Munich's is the new book from the author of two previous literary footballing books, David Peace. He previously wrote the acclaimed and controversial The Damned United, which detailed Brian Clough's times as Leeds United manager, all 44 days of it, and Red or Dead, whose protagonist was Bill Shankly, the famed manager of Liverpool Football Club. Now his third football novel, Munich's, deals with the tragedy of the Manchester United team whose plane crashed while attempting to take off from Munich Airport in 1958. 44 people were on board, 23 died. 19 of the 21 survivors suffered a range of injuries. Amongst those who died were the plane's captain, 8 players of Manchester United, three club staff members, 8 members of the media. David Peace's Munich's is a fictional reimagining of the tragedy from multiple viewpoints, and hence the plural title, Munich's. Our colleague Damien O'Mara has been reading Munich's. Just before we go into that corner of Manchester, definitely maybe was the first CD you ever bought. You've just
first
admitted.
CD. I have it. I found it in my parents' in my old childhood bedroom the other day with the receipt from Golden Disc still in it. And I have, they played The Point in December 97, 3 nights. Noel Gallagher sang solo the second and third nights. Liam had a throat problem. Mm. I still have the ticket. They were personalised tickets with the band's picture on them. £19.
Oh,
you won't get a t-shirt. You won't get the sleeve of a t-shirt,
you know,
in Crow Park for £19.
You might get a good price for your original, definitely maybe CD. Anyway, we shouldn't get bogged down in further Oasis.
I'm looking for 2 euro tickets.
Let's get bogged down in a day in the Munich, the air disaster. Devastating, obviously, for all of those involved, the wider footballing community in Manchester. It really is part of what led to Manchester United's iconic status later on into the 60s, 70s and 80s.
Yeah, 100%. And it's one of those incidents which transcended sport. You're talking about something that happened early in February in 1958, where an awful lot of people, even non-Manchester United fans, can tell you intimate details of what it was that happened. And in a way, you look at events like Hillsborough, which is around Liverpool, the Ibrox Stadium disaster around Rangers, the Bradford Stadium fire. It's one of those incidents which, to this day, is part of the fabric of those football clubs. And I think with Manchester United, it kind of fed into the fact that it was such a brilliant young team, which we might touch upon.
Yeah, we'll do actually. To put people in the picture of, because 1958, you know, this was a very young Manchester team. Matt Busby was...
Yeah, they were the Busby Babes.
Yeah, and they were called the Busby Babes. And they all had such potential, yeah. Everybody felt.
And, you know, people talk about Duncan Edwards, who was one of the players who lost, who to this day, people who saw him play will say he was one of the most naturally skillful players to ever play for Manchester United. It was a generation and a group of players who had largely come through the youth ranks at Manchester United. A lot of local players, a lot of players who were from the northwest of England, if not from Manchester itself, and basically just epitomised the hope that existed amongst that part of the country, that if you're a young footballer and you want to be a part of this famed football team, here is a generation that have done so much and had so much success under Matt Busby, who is still to this day the patriarch of Manchester United.
Yeah, people, and I mean, when he died, there was such a...
Yeah.
They're like an outpouring
and
of
listen,
grief.
People still, there are still flags paying tribute to the Busby Babes. There are still people. There are people who never saw them play or weren't alive at the time of the Munich air disaster who can name you that entire team. Like a terribly tragic situation. We're playing a European Cup game in Belgrade, had qualified for the semi-finals of the European Cup. At a time when English clubs hadn't really embraced European competition, and Busby was very much at the forefront of that, played in Belgrade, plane landed in Munich to refuel on its journey back to Manchester. 2 attempts to take off, unsuccessful. 3rd attempt, hit a wall, hit a house, hit a barn, hit a fuel truck, and a massive explosion and terrible tragedy.
And that was part of the reason for so many deaths, the explosion subsequent to the impact. How does the book begin then?
It's a very tight timeline. So the crash on the 6th of February 1958, it runs to the FA Cup final, which took place in June of that year. And we're straight into it pretty much. There's a very short prologue in which Jack Charlton and Bobby Charlton's mother, Sissy, almost has a premonition that something terrible is going to befall Bobby. But straight away, you're into the crash. And one of the great strengths of David Peace's writing is just this graphic imagery. And you've got, throughout the book, he goes from life in Munich, be it the crash or be it those who are in hospital in the aftermath of the crash, back to Manchester and the initial uncertainty around what has happened and then the attempt to rebuild the club. But the passages at the start of the book, when we're in the crash, the energy in the prose is unbelievable, and it just generates such an image of the chaos and the mania and the panic and the terror of what had unfolded. And we're straight into it from the opening page.
And Matt Busby was on the plane. Bobby Charlton was on the plane. How does Peace treat their stories? The Bobby Charlton story in particular is interesting.
Bobby Charlton blamed himself for the fate that had befallen a lot of the players. And it was even, and this is recounted in the latter stages of the book, and it's important, we've touched upon it, this is a work of fiction based on real life characters and real life events, and we'll expand on that. But Busby repeatedly over the course of his life, he'd never shied away from the guilt that he felt at the fact that these were players, in some cases, who didn't want to go on the trip or were injured or had other things in their lives that they wanted to try and focus on. And he effectively had, in his mind, had forced them or had brought them to Munich. I won't say he's a background character, but he suffered such horrific injuries. And at one point, his own life was touch and go, that he was like bedridden in hospital for a considerable spell of time. And, you know, for a lot of the book, he is this character that we are not sure, is he going to make it or not? And, you know, there's the uncertainty around, you know, is he going to pull through? Is he not going to pull through? The guilt comes more towards the latter stages of the book. Bobby Charlton, who, you know, obviously continued his career and was such a big part of their subsequent European Cup campaign a decade later, again, guilt is a massive issue.
He said he was never going to play football again,
didn't he? And never largely spoke about the Munich air disaster. Like, touched upon it once or twice later in life. It's recounted in the book that he told those close to him on separate occasions his experiences and his observations and his memories of the event, on the basis that he would never have to speak to them about it again. And even, like, I remember situations, you know, where he would have appeared on programmes on this radio station over the years, and there is that inevitable thing that people want to talk to him about it, but he would largely bat it away. It was never something he went into in intimate detail. He's a big part of the rebuilding of the club. It's touch and go. Is he going to come to play football again?
And yet you're talking about, you know, we know that he played for Manchester United subsequently. And I suppose that's testament to Peace's writing, that just, even though we know what happened, somehow he turns it into a what's going to happen now.
I know this story inside out, and I have met Harry Gregg. Our colleague Adrian Eames won a radio award a couple of years ago for a brilliant piece where Harry Gregg relived the Munich air disaster. You know, I think it was one of the anniversaries.
He was one of the players.
He was a Derry-born goalkeeper who climbed back into the wreckage to try and, you know, save his colleagues and save those on board. Like, I've read books about this. I've watched films about this. I know this story fairly intimately. But yet, I found myself not able to put this book down. And sorry, there's a passage, Duncan Edwards, who we've touched upon. Duncan Edwards lived for 15 days after the crash and ultimately succumbed to very significant internal injuries. I know Duncan Edwards died, but the tension that is built up around, will he, won't he? Like, I was in ribbons reading it.
I do want you to talk a little bit about Liam or Billy Whelan, the Dublin footballer who did die in the crash, and how that is handled. I think this section of the book worked particularly well.
Yeah, so like, you know, Liam Whelan, Billy Whelan, he was early 20s, 22, I think. You know, Cabra, there's a bridge named after him a couple of hundred yards away from Dalymount Park. I thought initially it was because it is such a brilliant setting of Dublin, and it's such a brilliant, like, he paints a picture of the Gresham Hotel and the Manchester United players coming over to Dalymount Park to play in matches. And like, it's a Dublin that I recognise so much. And I thought it was just me, but he recounts all of the funerals, but it's the Liam Whelan one that really jumped out
and
for
you
me.
Don't think that was that, you know, obviously you'd have more connection to an Irish player.
Do you know what it was? I sat beside his brother in Dalymount for years.
Liam Whelan's brother, yeah.
Christy, without realising that he was Liam Whelan's brother. I just knew him as Christy. And I did think initially it was the connection, and then you're reading the reviews and it comes up in all of the reviews that, and it's part of the horror of a time in Ireland, a time across the UK and Ireland where there wasn't wall-to-wall news, there were radio reports filtering through, someone lands at the door, the Evening Herald down on O'Connell Street says this has happened, they're trying to tune in the BBC radio, the neighbour two doors up has a phone, he's a taxi driver, he gets the phone call, and it is so stark and it is so heartbreaking and it's powerful.
And yet, I know you were telling me before we came to air that it reads like a newspaper report rather than a piece of fiction.
It reads like a non-fiction. Yeah. That passage is like a non-fiction.
But you're
account.
Uncomfortable with some of the fictional elements. Now, you mentioned Sissy Charlton, the mother of Bobby and Jack, and how she has, in inverted commas, a premonition.
Yeah.
Stuff like that you weren't comfortable
listen,
with?
Listen, I don't know if it was like, it almost felt like voyeurism or if it was like this Catholic guilt about how we treat the dead, but I'm reading it and then you're kind of forgetting for a moment that these are real life people. Mm. And listen, The Damned United was a fantastic piece of work, but it was a deeply controversial piece of work because a lot of the protagonists in it were still alive. John Giles had a successful libel action as a result of it, but they challenged a lot of it. There's no one to challenge this because they've
so
all
So do you
passed.
Think this will be controversial?
I don't know. It's only in the shops today. I found elements of the conversations between the individuals and the imagined thoughts of the individuals to be slightly uncomfortable. Yeah. There's only a reference at the very end of the book about this is a work of fiction. There's over 60 books cited. There's a whole load. There's a big bibliography at the end of the book of the people that he has quoted and the research he's done. He's a meticulous researcher. It's a rip-roaring read, but there is a debate to be had about the line between fact and fiction. Faction, I'm told it's called. And, you know, is there an ethical element? Is there an ethical element to this? I'm a little bit uncomfortable with passages.
I don't know if he'll put that in his next book. It's a rip-roaring reading. It's a rip-roaring reading, but.
Yeah, now listen, I enjoyed it. I would recommend it, but I was slightly uneasy with elements of it.
Perfect. That's great. Thanks for that, Damien O'Mara. Munich's by David Peace, published by Faber. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Research this evening was by Barbara Rose Sanwell. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 6:30 here on RTE Radio 1. And John Creedon is on the way.